This event is presented by the Council on Foreign Relations.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to the Council on Foreign Relations Religion and Foreign Policy Conference Call Series. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. As a reminder, today's call is on the record, and the audio and transcript will be available on our website, cfr.org, and on our iTunes podcast channel, Religion and Foreign Policy. We're delighted to have Lori Esposito-Murray with us today for a discussion on nuclear proliferation and arms control. Lori Esposito-Murray is an adjunct senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Prior to coming to CFR, she held the Distinguished National Security Chair at the U.S. Naval Academy. She previously served as a consultant to President George W. Bush's Commission on Weapons of Mass Destruction and U.S. Intelligence Capabilities. Dr. Murray was special advisor to President Bill Clinton on the Chemical Weapons Convention. She was also responsible for multilateral negotiations on nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons issues at the U.S. Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. She is also currently an adjunct professor at the University of Connecticut and President Emeritus of the World Affairs Councils of America. Lori, thanks very much for being with us. I thought we could begin with you giving us an overview of the nuclear arms control and nuclear policy and tell us why you think we are really at the crossroads now.
Well, thank you, Irina. Thank you for the invitation. I'd like to thank everyone participating in the phone call, given the importance of this issue and the work many of you have done. The crossroads. This is a very 2019 is a very important year, and one of the major trends that has put us at a crossroad is the fact that both nuclear arms control policy and nuclear arms policy is hitting major decision points. And what is at stake is the historic progress that U.S. and Russia have made since 1986. In terms of deep reductions. In 1986, we were at the level of 70,000 nuclear weapons worldwide. Over 95% of those were U.S. and Russia. And today, because of the arms control process and because of unilateral strategy decisions made by both the U.S. and Russia, we are down to 15,000 nuclear weapons worldwide. That's an 80% reduction in the number of nuclear weapons. And in 2019, we are standing at a crossroad. The threats are changing. We're seeing the rise of great power competition, which is making nuclear deterrence once again take center stage, because nuclear deterrence was seen as much more effective against major powers, major states, and not as effective against terrorist threats. So you see nuclear deterrence as a policy taking center stage again. We have advancing technologies, hypersonics, going 15 times the speed of sound, advances in both offense and defense technologies. AI is playing a critical role in that as well. And this is all happening while the arms control regime is collapsing. We have seen the end of the INF agreement and New START, which brought us down to 1,550 deployable nuclear weapons apiece between us and Russia, is ending in February of 2021, and it doesn't look like it will that an extension is pending, or even less likely is a follow-on agreement. And so this is a really critical turning point, both in terms of U.S. and Russia policy and global policy on arms control. And you know, keep in mind that U.S. and Russia still possess 90% of the nuclear weapons worldwide. And at a time when the arms control regime is collapsing and the proliferation threat is rising, with North Korea, Iran, and every other nuclear power, including India and Pakistan, modernizing their nuclear weapons.
Thank you. Let's open up to questions. Hello? Yes. Operator, we can open up to questions.
At this time, we will open up the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key, followed by the one key, on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, press star 2. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1.
Lori, while we wait for questions to queue up, can you talk a little bit about the flashpoints we're seeing now with Iran, North Korea, and India, Pakistan?
Yeah, those are the three major flashpoints, and just the fact that we're facing three major flashpoints all at the same time involving nuclear weapons also highlights how we really are at a turning point in terms of the significance of these weapon systems once again, and also their destabilizing nature. With North Korea, we're on a particular timeline. Kim Jong-un has said that he would give the Trump administration until the end of the year, and that's kind of been lost in all of the news coverage of President Trump being invited to Pyongyang, possibly, and what's going to be the follow-up after Hanoi, and is denuclearization the policy we should be pursuing? In fact, there's a timeline there that Kim Jong-un has set out that is just a couple of months away. Of course, in Iran, since the Trump administration pulled out of the Iran deal in May of 2018, we have seen increasing tensions with Iran as the president's maximum pressure strategy really had a powerful effect on crippling the Iranian economy. Prior to the Iran situation, in terms of sanctions, it was a dogma that to do sanctions, you really need a multilateral support. And what the president has shown with our policy on Iran is that the U.S. alone can really, with secondary sanctions, can really, given its economic power, can really bring down an economy. We've isolated Iran from the international financial markets. Their currency has lost 60% of its value against the U.S. dollar. We've cut their oil exports dramatically, and this is actually against a very powerful coalition of countries: Russia, China, EU, Germany, France, Britain, all parties to the Iran deal who wanted to see it succeed. This has led to increased tensions in the Gulf, which actually accelerated, of course, just a couple of months ago with the drone strikes and the commandeering tankers, very aggressive. As Iran has gotten more and more aggressive, and now, of course, we're facing the situation of what's happened to the Saudi oil facilities and just raising it to a very significant flashpoint. And then, of course, in India and Pakistan, the area, the Kashmiri area, has actually intensified over the past 2 years. But a major and significant turning point happened when Modi announced on August 5th, or it was announced on August 5th, that they were going to actually no longer recognize the autonomy of the Indian side of the of Kashmir, and once again putting that situation turning that situation into a powder keg. So those are the three major areas facing us today, dealing with the nuclear weapons issue.
Terrific. Next question, please.
We'll take our next question from Charles Stromer with Wisdom Project.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call, and I appreciate your time with us here. So have you heard of any calls for disarming multilaterally, moving beyond just arms control to maybe getting countries to disarm multilaterally sort of at the same rate, reducing the threats, full access, policing, things like that? To bring about peace rather than just sort of maintaining the status quo where everybody's got, or a few people have, a few countries have nuclear weapons.
Can I just ask for clarification that disarming multilaterally, including nuclear weapons and conventional weapons, or just on the nuclear side?
Oh, good question. Well, can we start with nukes, or do they have to be polluted? Or can we do one without the other? I don't really know.
Okay. On the nuclear issue, there are two major multilateral efforts. Of course, one is the nuclear ban treaty, and that was open for signature in 2017, and it needs 50 nations to ratify or accede to it, and the nuclear ban treaty actually bans nuclear weapons the way the chemical weapons treaty bans chemical weapons the way we have the norm on the biological weapons of a ban. But in September 2017, you have the nuclear ban treaty was open for signature. You need 50 nations to ratify or accede to it. And right now there are 70 signatories, but of that, only 28 nations are actually state parties that actually ratified or acceded to it. So that's one effort. And actually, that's an effort that the religious communities have been very involved in, including the highest level of Pope Francis participating in helping to frame that agreement. And then the other effort is the one that President Trump had announced that he's interested in, and Secretary Pompeo has actually been pursuing in terms of seeing if there was any interest with the Russia-China-U.S. multilateral approach to the problem of these intermediate nuclear forces after we got out of the intermediate nuclear forces agreement to try and handle the issue multilaterally with Russia and China. The Chinese have indicated that they have no interest in doing that at this point. That was their first response. But it is an effort the administration is continuing to see if they could roll out.
Thank you.
Next question.
We'll take our next question from Deanne Butterfield with Friends Committee.
Hi. Thanks a lot. My question is about sanctions. The narrative is very confusing because sanctions are supposed to be a way to get the adversary to the negotiating table. But what's evolving is that sanctions are just there as an offensive strategy toward, I don't know, what kind of end. And so we note that when sanctions don't work, the call is for more sanctions. And when military action doesn't work, the call is for more military action. But when people say diplomacy doesn't work, then the call is for sanctions and military action. What suggestions do you have to frame the sanctions tool, connecting it back to diplomacy?
That is an excellent question, and that is really the dilemma of sanctions policy. And I would actually argue that we are right now in an important defining moment in the sanctions, maximum sanctions pressure with Iran. And to your point, we put the pressure on, we've hit the economy pretty significantly, and then it's a matter of capturing a diplomatic moment in terms of recognizing it on the part of the U.S. as well as getting Iran to recognize that this is a moment that we really need to talk. And what's interesting is I think that has actually been recognized not only by you hear President Trump saying that he's talking more frequently about wanting to talk to the Iranians, but you had President Macron actually playing an intermediary role at the G7. Where Foreign Minister Zarif was actually in Paris, and he was trying to move the Iranian crisis forward in terms of diplomacy. We have seen sanctions work in terms of diplomacy, and that was with the original Iran deal. And it was in 2012 that President Obama got the European allies to really intensify sanctions, hit the oil sector of Iran, also go after the banking sector. The impact was pretty sharp and severe, and we moved to negotiating the Joint Comprehensive Agreement with Iran. So, you know, we have seen even just recently sanctions work, but in order to work, you need to know where the you have to provide a de-escalation ladder that will allow diplomacy to take its course. Otherwise, as you were saying, you're just in this spiral of more and more sanctions, and which don't necessarily lead to regime change. And even if they do lead to regime change, you're just leading to chaos. And you know, the last thing we need is another black hole of country in the Middle East after we've watched what's happened in Syria and Libya. We're also watching what's happening in Venezuela, now part of the world. And, you know, it's important to try and capture and utilize the leverage that it does give you for a diplomatic solution. Because sanctions in and of themselves are not a policy. They're a leverage to a policy.
Thank you. Next question.
We'll take our next question from Daniel Hall with SGI USA.
Hi, thank you. My question was actually related to one that was already asked. So I wanted to know if you thought that with the breakdown of bilateral arms control agreements and negotiations, that multilateral instruments such as the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons might become more attractive to nation states that have not yet ratified, or is it simply going to compel them to hold on to their weapons more strongly and to their nuclear umbrella protections more strongly? And on that, as a follow-up, what is the role of civil society in pushing those nations that have not ratified this treaty yet and pushing them into doing so?
So, you know, what is really key here, and thank you for the that question on the Prohibition Treaty, which is, you know, really important in terms of the role it plays. I do think, unfortunately, the changing threat, the rise of competition among Russia and China, increasing tensions in the Middle East, North Korea's pursuit of its nuclear weapons program, and then what seems to be almost a breakdown that's happening between India and Pakistan. That, unfortunately, the importance of nuclear weapons and the increased role for nuclear weapons and deterrence is going to be where we are heading. So increasing the role of nuclear weapons and deterrence policy and the importance of nuclear deterrence policy is the reality of where we're heading as a global community. But having said that, what's really interesting, if you look back to the 1980s, the pressure, the civil society pressure and the pressure that the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons places as a balance or as a pullback on that is extremely important. In the 1980s, as we were pursuing and dealing with a competition in Europe with intermediate range systems and the Russian and the Soviet Russian deployments, there was a tremendous amount of civil concern, protest in Europe, in the United States, and that played a large role in terms of opening the door for diplomatic solutions. And what you saw Reagan and Gorbachev do then was eventually, after the Reykjavik summit, led to the INF agreement and then to the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty process, which brought us down 80%, as I was mentioning, in these, you know, which contributed in large part to bringing us down 80%. In nuclear weapons between the U.S. and Russia. I mean, there were some unilateral decisions we made, but the arms control process was an important part of that. So civil society and public pressure is really important, I think, in terms of providing an opening for diplomatic solutions. And what I'm really concerned about now is however many years since the collapse of the Soviet Union, there has been very little attention paid to nuclear weapons. And so we're dealing with several generations, I think, of Americans and global citizens who are really not aware or have not been thinking about nuclear weapons and why nuclear weapons are different and why we should be concerned about them.
Thank you. Next question.
We'll take our next question from Satpal Singh with State University of New York.
Thanks for taking my question. I have a question on what role can leaders of faith play in mitigating the increasing threat? What approaches are possible that can be effective? And are there any attempts being made by leaders of faith beyond what Pope Francis, you mentioned, did? And it's also related to the question that some of the major conflict threats, like, for example, in India and Pakistan, come from religious sentiments. So what is being done and what can be done? Thanks.
So I'm sorry, you were breaking up a little. I just want to make sure I understand the question. You were mentioning that religious sentiment has played a role in the conflict in India and Pakistan, and what can be done about that? Is that?
Yeah. What role can faith leaders, religious leaders, play in mitigating such threats, not only on religious conflict, but in general across the world?
Right. I think a very important role. You know, as I said, I think the 1980s show is a perfect example of how the U.S. and Russia, the superpowers, were moving away from diplomacy and arms control, and it was the religious leaders who played a very important and significant role globally in terms of raising awareness and concern about what direction we were heading. And needless to say, when dealing with a situation like India-Pakistan, where religion actually plays a role in the tensions, I think there's a very significant role in that particular issue. But I also think globally and worldwide, the most important, I think, number one agenda that we should be focusing on right now is extending New START and just keeping those deep reduction levels in place. That sounds like a very baseline thing to be working for. Unfortunately, it's something that could so easily happen, but it's actually at risk. And I think focusing on extending New START and keeping the level of reductions that we've achieved between the U.S. and the Russians in place on the strategic systems is something that is, I think, the most important short-term issue to focus on. And then in terms of these other flashpoints, as well as the larger global issue, I think keeping the pressure on to make sure, going back to the question about sanctions leading to more sanctions and military leading to more military when it doesn't work, or it's the answer here is using either military power or sanctions power to open up leverage for diplomacy. And that's where the religious community can really be putting pressure and direction to say, use this. If you've got this leverage, if we're moving in these very tense directions, it's critical that we take the opportunity to deal with this diplomatically.
Thank you. Next question.
Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. We'll take our next question from Thomas Walsh with Universal Peace Coalition.
All right. Thank you for today's discussion and fielding these questions. I wanted to bring up the issue about cyber warfare both as carried out by nuclear powers that are also, I guess, developing a kind of mutually assured destruction capacity. Some argue that is as dangerous as the nuclear threat that could impact power grids and water and power that sustain people's lives, even if it takes a longer period of time. If how that factors into your thinking about this topic. And then secondly, apart from, let's say, the nuclear power club, are, you know, cyber criminals or kind of asymmetrical pieces that could invade nuclear systems and create disastrous consequences. So I guess I'd just like you to, as much as you like or feel comfortable, if you could expand the discussion into that area a little bit.
Sure, sure. I really see the cyber challenge and threat is really, I think, on several distinct levels. I mean, one is the cyber criminals, as you mentioned, or the cyber individual hackers. I mean, it's a tool that anyone can use. Then there's state-sponsored criminal activity, espionage. And then you move into the top tier, which is when you have state-sponsored massive attacks, cyber attacks on critical infrastructure that can really bring down a society, whether that's the financial structure or the electrical grid, on a massive level. And I think when you're looking at cyber, I would like to make a distinction if you're looking on that massive level in terms of comparing it to nuclear. I think cyber effects are catastrophic. I think nuclear is existential. And that's, I think, a critical difference between both of these capabilities. Nuclear still holds the existential threat to humanity because of the devastating, destructive power of these weapons. But cyber becomes existential when you combine it with nuclear. And that's if you overtake or challenge the command and control systems of nuclear weapons, or if you attack nuclear civilian power plants on a massive level, causing 10, 20, 30 Chernobyls all at once. And so I think when you combine the cyber with nuclear, you get to an existential potential. And that's what I think as an international community, we have to deal with the cyber on all levels, and also cyber as a catalyst for an escalating conflict. But I think the principal focus should be on setting rules and norms, or in terms of behavior as far as cyber and nuclear weapons, as well as trying to defend against that, and by enhancing the security of both our civilian nuclear facilities as well as our command and control of our military nuclear facilities weapons. And so that's basically how I look at it. And I think we should really start with an effort immediately at the top, and particularly as AI becomes plays more of a role in command and control, to start trying to get global norms at that highest level of a massive cyber attack, and then work to develop norms in terms of the other areas as well.
Just a quick one. As you were speaking, which I very much appreciate, just the issue emerged in my mind was about how whether, say, the U.S. and Russia have the capacity, or they have each planted malware in each other's nuclear systems in such a way that you know, it would disable their capacities and therefore intensify threats or something. I think this, you know, what you call the existential and the more humanitarian disaster aspect, I guess they're becoming more and more intertwined.
Right, which is, you know, where cyber can actually threaten a nuclear catastrophe or actually trigger a nuclear catastrophe. You know, it plays a role, it plays a part in a nuclear use of nuclear weapons. And you know, that is what, especially as we are modernizing these nuclear systems, and digitizing the nuclear systems. And this is something that Strategic Command and the Pentagon are very aware of and trying to figure out, how do you modernize and try to ensure the security of your systems as you modernize them? Yeah. But it's a very, very serious issue.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next question.
We'll take our next question from Mary Yelnick with Pax Christi International.
Yes, thank you very much. I was wondering if you could elaborate a bit on the use of the word deterrence. You've used it several times, and you say that you suspect that the policies are going to be moving more in that direction. It seems that there's an argument that the existence and the recent proliferation of nuclear weapons among formerly non-nuclear nations suggests that there's an incentive for those non-nuclear nations to acquire nuclear weapons, and witness North Korea. They're paid attention to finally when they have a nuclear weapon, and witness what happened in Iraq when Saddam Hussein got rid of his nuclear program. He was attacked. So how does the existence of a nuclear weapon in a country operate as deterrence? Thank you.
So, thank you. The point I was making about deterrence plan, nuclear deterrence, I mean, deterrence will always be a part of human society, deterrence in general, in terms of how people relate to each other, countries relate to each other. Deterrence is just, I think, a part of how human society relates. But nuclear deterrence, I just want to separate that out. The nuclear deterrence is, I was mentioning, becoming, I think, more significant or regaining its significance with the rise of great power competition, because nuclear deterrence is seen as more effective against the nation state, that you can deter a nation state with the threat of a nuclear weapon, as opposed to when we saw the top threat over the past several years being from terrorism, that it's very hard to deter a terrorist with a nuclear weapon, since they're much more amorphous, they don't control territory, and harder to find. And so deterrence is challenged by, and not as effective against terrorism, but it is effective against a nation state. And so that's why I was saying you're going to see the relevance of nuclear deterrence reinvigorated as we move into this era of great power competition, and which we're already in. And but to a larger point of North Korea, I mean, part of the reason, and almost all analysts agree on this, that the reason why Kim Jong-un is developing nuclear weapons is to ensure that he's not invaded. And so for security. There are other reasons why he's developing nuclear weapons, which is obviously prestige, as you mentioned, so that here you have one of the poorest nations in the world, you know, that countries and major powers are paying, all three major powers are paying attention to, U.S., Russia, and China. All three leaders are meeting with him. And so you get the prestige that comes with it. But I think we can deal, even as it becomes more important among in terms of its relevance in the great power competition, I still think, and we've proven this over the years, that you can ensure other countries that their security does not require nuclear weapons. And if you look at the Non-Proliferation Treaty, how many countries are in the Non-Proliferation Treaty? I mean, there are 192 state parties, with a handful of those being the nuclear powers. And we've managed to effectively, we as a global community have managed to effectively ensure the security and convince most nations that they don't need nuclear weapons in order to for prestige, for development, for security. And so we have been successful at that, even while nuclear weapons have played a role among the great powers. But I also want to emphasize, because there's so little credit given to the U.S. and Russia since 1986 to today. It was in February of this past year that we hit the low-level reductions in the New START process, and there's so little credit given to the U.S. or Russia for reducing 80%, going from 70,000 nuclear weapons worldwide to 15,000 over that time period. And so we've seen significant progress even among the two major possessors of nuclear weapons, and we continue to be the two major possessors of nuclear weapons, having 90% of the nuclear weapons between us and the Russians.
Thank you. Next question.
We'll take our next question from Dennis Freda with Lutheran Office for World Divinity.
Yes. Thank you, Dr. Murray. Acknowledging what you just said about progress in nuclear arms reduction with New START, I wanted to ask your views on how we can get the U.S. and Russia back to the bilateral negotiations in relation to the INF treaty now that the U.S. has walked away from it? And is there a role for civil society in that specific case? Thanks.
Yes, there is an important role for civil society. And in this, you know, in INF, the onus is really on Vladimir Putin. And you know, in 2007, he announced at the Munich Security Conference that he wanted to, that he no longer saw the INF treaty as viable, and started the process then to get out of the INF treaty by developing, testing, and now deploying the INF systems. And it's President Obama raised this to the highest level. He wrote a letter to President Putin directly saying how important it was that he come back into the INF agreement and the significance of the agreement. And we've met over 30 times with the Russians since then trying to address this issue. And so it's very hard to stay in an agreement when another country has actually started deploying those weapon systems. And so here's where civil society pressure can play a really important role because it's very hard. We weren't able on the diplomatic level, on the highest level in our governments, to convince the Russians that they needed, that they shouldn't be moving in that direction. And I think this is where civil society on a global level putting pressure on all of the major powers to regarding these issues is extremely important in terms of raising it on their priority level and making it an issue that they have to respond to. I think you have a very, very important role to play.
Thank you. Next question.
We'll take our next question from Ronald Stone.
Thank you, Dr. Murray. Which countries do you suspect of working on nuclear weapon development beyond our disputes with Iran?
Beyond Iran and North Korea, well, that's the that is really the challenge and the challenge of dealing with Iran and North Korea. How those situations unfold and where we end up is going to have a significant impact on how other countries look at nuclear weapons, particularly in those regions. And in terms of North Korea, if North Korea continues to develop and maintain its nuclear weapons, you're going to see pressure from within Japan and within South Korea, and it's already happening in terms of debates as to whether they should be actually possessing their own nuclear weapons as opposed to relying on the United States for its deterrent nuclear capability. And so you're going to see proliferation pressures developing, and the same thing in Iran. If Iran develops a nuclear weapons capability, you're going to see pressure within Saudi Arabia, which we're already seeing in terms of
pressure to develop nuclear weapons, where the Saudis have already said if Iran develops a nuclear weapon, they're going to develop a nuclear weapon. So, you know, this isn't just guesswork. And countries are already talking about that. And you can see the proliferation push that happens, particularly with those two countries, since North Korea has already developed a nuclear weapons capability and you know, Iran has the potential to develop one pretty quickly. Just the pressure point they're going to put on the whole proliferation issue. I do want to say, particularly there have been a number of questions about the role of civil society. I just want to add that one of the most important things that civil society can do today, and I had alluded to this earlier, was the education level on these issues and the focus on these issues and educating the American public and your communities about nuclear weapons. I mean, that has really – nuclear weapons have really disappeared from discussion in the United States after the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1992. It was considered the Soviet threat went away, and so did the nuclear threat, although the nuclear weapons were still there.
In our community, Daniel Ellsberg's new book, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner, has inspired some presbytery action and public discussion in Pittsburgh. I wondered, would you be willing to comment on the wisdom of that book and particularly his strong advocacy of a no first strike commitment?
You know, I haven't read the book. I read a book review a while ago, and so having not read the book, I'm you know a little reluctant to comment on it. I know there are a lot of people, particularly on talk shows, who do comment about things they don't read. I hold to that standard.
As a professor, I respect your reluctance.
thank you.
Some of the religious communities that I've mentioned have been urging adoption of a no-first-strike policy, as have major theologians in some of our churches. Would you comment on the contribution of pressure on the no-first-strike?
So regarding no-first-strike, there are a number of countries that have no-first-strike policy, including the Indians and the Chinese. You know, from my view, the problem with the no-first-strike policy is that even though a country may announce it, you still have to doubt it and incorporate that doubt into your strategic policy. To me it's a little bit of a conundrum in terms of what it really does mean and whether it's really effective, and whether a country would, you know, or the U.S. if it announced a no first strike policy, whether it would actually abide by it, and you know, and does it really help you in terms of trying to convince other nations not to attack you first if you have a no first strike policy. So I see that's a little bit more complex on the surface. I think it's very appealing, but even watching it in practice with both the Indians and the Chinese, it's very hard to take it seriously when you're looking, and particularly when you're looking at things, tensions increasing in the regions or among countries, just how to factor that in and whether you can really factor it in and take it seriously.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for that. And let's go to our next question.
Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star one. We'll take our next question from Joseph Paul Martin with Barnard College.
Hello, I hope you can hear me. I never know exactly. My question is then, what's the agenda for dealing with non-state actors that have weapons or the threat of weapons of mass destruction?
Non-state actors, the critical agenda there, and this was actually started by President Obama and raised to the highest level, he held four summits while he was president, one every 2 years, and had over 40 leaders of nations come to these summits, with the last one being in Washington, and on nuclear security. And the whole point of nuclear security was to try and either lock down or secure these materials or remove them and from countries. And when the process started, there were close to 50 countries with weapon-grade nuclear material. And at the end of his 8 years, we were that was cut by half, where countries actually agreed to remove the nuclear material from their nation state. And Ukraine was one of those, and that happened before the Russians actually invaded, before Putin invaded Ukraine. So so the policy, since deterrence was seen as not being effective, the policy really switched to trying to lock down, control, and remove the material, weapons-grade material. And it's absolutely critical that we continue that effort, which has now moved to a high-level group globally and is not having the same impact or effectiveness as it did during the Obama years, since it has fallen off the priority list. It's still among our efforts that we're doing, but it's fallen down in terms of priority list, in terms of U.S. diplomacy and leadership.
Great, thank you. Next question.
We'll take our next question from Doug Hostetter with Pax Christi International.
Hi, Dr. Murray. Thank you very much for taking the time to meet with us. I have actually a two-part question. One, there are a number of weapons of mass destruction, chemical and biological, and they have been made illegal by international law because of the fact that they are, in fact, weapons of mass destruction and would violate the rules of law. Can you explain to me why nuclear weapons have not been included in prohibition so far? And then the second part of my question would be, you've worked for several American administrations, and I wonder whether you think that the United States government would actually abide by the treaty for the prohibition of nuclear weapons if it actually became international law. Thank you.
On the first question as to why nuclear weapons haven't been included in a ban until this point, it's interesting. It's taken years on the biological and chemical issues. And the biological weapons issue is basically a norm, not really a treaty. It pretty much focusing on the chemical and biological pretty much grew out of World War I with the concerns and use of particularly chemical weapons during World War I, and you had the Geneva Convention. And so you basically had a norm. And it took years. We still don't have a convention on biological weapons that's verifiable with verification provisions, but we do have the Chemical Weapons Convention. And that took years to negotiate. It's a comprehensive treaty. It bans chemical weapons. It has extensive verification procedures and has been, we've seen the removal of thousands of tons of nuclear weapons, of chemical weapons worldwide under the Chemical Weapons Convention. As I said, this has been a process. The Chemical Weapons Convention was ratified in 1997, I believe, and came into force in 1997, which isn't really that long ago. So looking at it in terms of a timeline, nuclear weapons have been seen as much more important, I think, in terms of deterring nuclear war. and much more significant in terms of military planning and in terms of deterrence. And I think that is why nuclear weapons have not been at the front end. But it's also just the, if you think about how long it's taken to do the other two, and we still don't have a verifiable convention on bio. If you look at it that way, it doesn't seem as skewed as if you look at it through the timeline perspective. Does that help?
Yeah. And the second question, if in fact the Treaty for the Prevention of Nuclear Weapons was became international law, do you think the United States government would abide by it?
I think there were some very serious concerns about ban and the effectiveness of the ban and the verification of a ban that is actually not only held by the U.S., but I'm sure you know this as many of you know this as well, that it's actually an issue with Russia, with China, with the other, with the P5, Britain, France, the U.S., in terms of concerns about the viability and effectiveness of the treaty if you were going to go to a complete ban. So I think there are serious concerns about it in terms of its security and verifiability. I'm just cautious about whether we will actually get to the point where you're going to get, particularly the P5, on board the ban treaty.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
We'll take our next question from Daniel Hall with SGI USA.
Hi. I wanted to ask a follow-up question to build on the discussion you've been leading on deterrence. Ever since the invention of nuclear weapons, deterrence has played a role in trying to create stability. However, the record of catastrophic use of nuclear weapons, either through intention or accident or miscalculation, has presented itself as a reality. Deterrence is not a guarantee that nuclear weapons and nuclear catastrophe can be avoided. And now that we are in this current situation with the development of cyber warfare, AI, hypersonic missiles, and with proliferation, greater opportunity for non-state actors to get access to nuclear weapons, is there an argument to be made that continuing down a path of nuclear deterrence is actually riskier than moving down a path of disarmament? And if so, why is that sense of risk and concern not more normalized within the security and foreign policy status quo? Because I don't hear that sense of concern or urgency or the growing risk part of the calculation often come out in the public discourse.
Thank you. It's an excellent question. It's actually the heart and soul of the whole issue. And I would actually take a little bit, a little bit different perspective on deterrence than what you just outlined, which is that the U.S. has never really totally relied on deterrence, even when as a sole policy. We've always incorporated arms control, even at the outset when in the Truman administration, after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, we had the Baruch plan and went to the UN with the Baruch plan, which was a disarmament plan for nuclear weapons, and actually looked at creating a fuel bank for civil nuclear facilities, an international fuel bank, but to get rid of nuclear weapons. And so we have, it's really fascinating because I think nuclear weapons are the only weapons in our arsenal that when they were introduced into the arsenal, so was arms control from the get-go. What's interesting is there was a very important turning point in terms of the seriousness of the need for diplomacy, arms control, to complement the deterrence policy in the Eisenhower administration. It was President Eisenhower who was utilizing brinkmanship. He solved, actually got the armistice in North Korea by threatening the use of nuclear weapons. He, faced with the shelling of the Formosa in 1956, he threatened the use of nuclear weapons. And he began to seriously think that purely relying on deterrence and brinkmanship was really, as you were saying, very destabilizing and dangerous. And, that's where you saw once he had an opportunity with the death of Stalin and Khrushchev coming into power that he actually started the Spirit of Geneva and then the test moratoriums and trying to improve U.S. or trying to add a diplomatic dimension to the U.S.-Soviet relations because deterrence and brinkmanship alone were an extremely dangerous policy. And so throughout the rest, throughout the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s, we have always combined this effort at arms control, and the Reagan administration became reductions, as I said, which led us to these historic reductions between the U.S. and Russia and the number of nuclear weapons worldwide. And we have always combined this arms control with a deterrence policy in order to provide more stability. And what concerns me now is we are, and which is why I see 2019 as a real turning point in terms of nuclear policy, is we are going back to a period where we are completely relying on nuclear deterrence, and we are the arms control piece and the stability piece the diplomatic piece of trying to deal with the existential nature of these weapons is collapsing. And that's why I think it's really critical, and this is where the role for civil society is extremely important in terms of both educating the American public and activating the American public to be aware of the seriousness of this issue and to try to ensure that our policy is not strictly a nuclear deterrence policy, that our policy is one that looks for more reductions, more stability, and less proliferation.
I'm going to try to squeeze in one final question.
We'll take our next question from Jonathan Fregis with Pac Christi International. Excuse me, sir, your line is live. Please ask your question.
Hello?
Yes, I hope I'm getting through. You are.
Yes. I'm calling from outside the U.S. with Pax Christi in Geneva. And I just wanted to follow up on a thread running through the discussion. Thank you very much for sharing your wisdom. What bears down on me from overseas is the extent, the strength of the two-tier system, the two classes, the nuclear powers and all the rest. And I think that the ban treaty breaks through that in a certain way. I'd like to ask what ways you see to change that mindset, which so often is just assumed as a given in the American disarmament community, I think. And then why the capacity of the ban treaty to actually show that we are all in the same boat by essentially saying Article 6 needs to be implemented and here's an extra push. So if you could answer on both of those levels, I'd be very grateful. Thank you.
So regarding the ban treaty and, the great power competition, which is beginning to define this era that we're in, or that is defining this new era we're in, really involves, specifically involves China and Russia. And I think if you just can't deal with U.S. policy in the abstract, you have to deal with U.S. policy in the context of defense, deterrence, threats. And so the policy of China and Russia are absolutely critical in terms of how the U.S. looks at these issues. on a top tier, and then the growing nuclear threat. You know, we seem to ignore the fact that India and Pakistan have the fastest growing nuclear arsenals worldwide. And not only the fastest growing, but, you know, extremely sophisticated in terms of advanced technologies. I mean, you know, India has just tested an anti-satellite system, and, you know, they are a society that is very much accomplished in terms of advanced technologies and becoming more and more accomplished. And so you need to look at this in terms of the whole vector of nuclear powers and how they of the nuclear powers and how they react to each other in order to, I think, move the issue forward.
But how is this any different from what has happened?
Excuse me?
Why isn't that exactly the same as the sort of downward spiral we entered into in the 1950s in the nuclear arms race, and the prospect in this globalized, interdependent, vulnerable world that we can do the same thing based on big power mentality? Surely there can be a debate in the biggest power of all that this is not a very productive road to go down.
You know, and it has been, and this is what what really frustrates me is that there's very little acknowledgement or credit given to the U.S. and to Russia for the 80% reductions in the nuclear weapons over the past year since 1986, and significant progress, and, you know, more has to be done. But we know how to do it, and we've been doing it together with the other possessor of 90% of the nuclear weapons worldwide. We need to engage the Chinese. They're launching, although they're far below the U.S. and Russia, they're launching a major modernization of their entire military, which includes their nuclear capabilities. And, we need to engage them in this process and have them understand the importance of arms control, stability, the significance of these weapons, and most critically, I think India and Pakistan as the next largest possessor of nuclear weapons. They're both at about 120 nuclear weapons apiece and fastest modernization. So it's really trying to, but tremendous progress has been made. We know how to do it. The U.S. and Russia know how to do it. Extending New START should be a very simple follow-on in order to hold the line so we could figure out how to deal with more advanced technologies as well as systems that aren't included in the strategic limits. And you would think that would be, an easy next step to take. Doesn't require any renegotiation, doesn't require Senate ratification because it's part of the treaty. So there are we know how to do this. There are steps we can take and to move us towards a more stable world where the role of nuclear weapons is reduced. We just need to reinvigorate this diplomatic process.
Well, we are unfortunately out of time and overtime, so I regret that we can't take any of the remaining questions. But Lori Esposito-Murray, thank you very much for sharing your valuable insights with us today, and to all of you for your terrific questions and comments. We look forward to continuing the dialogue. We encourage you to follow Lori Esposito-Murray's work on these issues. We also encourage you to follow CFR's Religion and Foreign Policy Program on Twitter at CFR_religion for announcements about upcoming events and information about the latest CFR resources. And you can always email us at outreach@cfr.org with any suggestions on future calls or events. So thank you again to Lori and to all of you.
For more event audio, subscribe on iTunes or visit us at cfr.org.